This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Late last week, it looked as if Republicans would win two important victories in Congress and deliver both the energy and the Medicare reform bills to the president's desk. They may yet, but it will not have been easy. The energy bill is stuck in the Senate after an attempt to cut off debate fell too short's vote on Friday. Then, very early Saturday morning, the House of Representatives passed the Medicare bill, but only by a very narrow margin and only after a long and dramatic night of legislative maneuvers. The battle on Medicare is now underway in the U.S. Senate, which voted to close debate on the bill less than an hour ago. We're going to talk with members from both sides of the aisle about Saturday morning's historic session in the House to find out what happened and why. We'll also check in on the Senate and ask how Republican Bill Frist is handling a major test as majority leader. Later in the program, telephone number portability. This is the first day that consumers can switch wireless companies without having to change their phone number and hold on to their landline number if they decide to cut the cord altogether. First, though, to Congress and to the energy and Medicare bills. Did you follow the maneuvering over the weekend? Will your representative or senator's vote on these bills affect your vote next November? How big a deal do you think this is going to be come election time? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And the email address is totn@npr.org. Joining us here in Studio 3A is NPR Senior Washington Editor Ron Elving. And always good to have you here, Ron.
My pleasure, Neil.
And we just mentioned the Senate voted to cut off debate, invoke cloture in their terminology less than an hour ago, but I understand there's still one more procedural vote before they can get to a straight up or down vote on Medicare.
Well, there may actually be several procedural votes, but they're all about the same question, and so they'll probably all be resolved the same way. That one question is, shall we waive the Budget Act with respect to the costs of this bill? Because on the scoring, the costs of the bill would indicate that they would bust the budget. That is the budget adopted just last year. And I think probably most people would agree that the costs as estimated are modest compared to what we'll actually see in reality. So this is not an entirely procedural matter, except that the Senate does require 60 votes to waive the Budget Act in such a moment. It has a substantive base, but it is a procedural vote to make sure they can proceed. Now, oftentimes when these budget points of order are raised and 60 votes are not attained, the bill dies right there. So this is perhaps, if you will, the last peril of Pauline.
Okay, but the vote on cloture was 70-29. Again, 60 votes were needed. That seems a pretty comfortable margin.
Yes, that would suggest that there's no problem. The bill is under control. But there do seem to be a number of Republicans who were, of course, going to vote for cloture. They don't want to submit to a Democratic-led filibuster, but who do have serious problems with the cost of this bill and who may, at this juncture, actually choose to rebel and vote for sustaining the point of order. And, of course, the Democrats who want to stop the bill will do so.
Okay. Now, remind us, how important are these two pieces of legislation?
Well, I think they're tremendously important. And, of course, you can always debate whether or not bills are going to do exactly what they say they're going to do, and they usually do some of what they say they're going to do, and then they do a great deal more that's unintended. So because of the unintended consequences, as much as for the intended, I would say these are tremendously important pieces of legislation for three reasons. First, the government policy. The energy bill, the Medicare bill, are going to change government policy substantially, and they're going to move it in some new directions. Some of those may be good, some of them may be what the critics say they'll be, but they're going to change policy. Just take a tiny example out of the energy bill. A relatively small amount of money being spent on hydrogen to develop a hydrogen-driven car. If that were to be successful, imagine how that would change our lives. Mm-hmm. Not to say that it will be, but that's the idea of spending $1 billion to develop such a car. On the Medicare side, whatever we look back in history and say about these changes, we're going to look back in history at these changes. We're going to say Medicare started to become a privatized or a semi-privatized program with the changes made in 2003. Or we're going to say Medicare became the basis for an ultimate national health insurance program that included not only seniors but everyone, and those changes began when we headed down that slope in the end of 2003. We don't really know which direction it's going to go, except to say that will depend on future elections and future Congresses. But we're going to head out into the unknown, the terra incognita, if you will, of the the new phase of Medicare as of this bill.
And you're talking about important items of public policy, but there is also some bare-knuckle politics involved in this that's going to be pretty important, too.
And that's the third thing I was referring to as the importance of these bills. Not just government policy and economics and the tremendous amount of money involved, but also the effect that they could have on the 2004 elections. I think an awful lot of seniors are going to get familiar with the provisions of this bill over the next 6, 8, 9 months, and that will have an effect on their votes. They'll either say, the president gave us what we wanted and what he said he would, and we're happy with the president, or they might be saying, wait a minute, this isn't what we thought it was. This isn't going to take care of our prescription drug problems, at least not in any kind of short-run way. We don't like the way we're changing our relationship to the Medicare program or moving into an HMO reliance. So we're unhappy. We're going to vote against the president, or we're going to vote against people who voted for the Medicare bill.
Mm-hmm. And let's not leave the energy bill out of this. That was really a stunner on Friday when the Senate fell too short's vote of invoking cloture.
That's correct. And, of course, they could still get those two votes. They've got 6 Republicans to go after. They've got 35 Democrats to go after and try to change 2 votes. They may yet do that. But it is not appearing at this moment that they'll do it today or tomorrow. It would have to be perhaps early next year that they bring the energy vote back. I'm not so convinced that the energy bill per se will change a lot of people's vote for president or for Congress next year. It might in some specific situations in some states, and particularly if the bill does eventually fail. There could be some recriminations for some of the farm state senators whose votes were not sufficient to get it done. But the farm state senators inoculated themselves by voting for the bill. They said, we want that corn-based ethanol provision that doubles the amount of money that's spent on corn-based ethanol in this country, and we did everything we could to make it law. If it failed, it wasn't because of that. It was because of other issues. So they should be all right.
And interestingly, look at the different coalitions on both bills. You have on the energy bill, as you say, Democrats from the Corn Belt voting with the administration and Republicans largely from the Northeast voting against it.
13 Democrats voted for cloture, and most of them, 10 of them, came from big grain and particularly corn-producing states. And you've got liberals here and populist liberals like Byron Dorgan or Tom Harkin voting, you know, side by side with the president's best friends in the Senate.
Going back to the Medicare bill, walk us through the weekend. How did the House end up voting on this legislation in the dead of night?
Well, they started voting on it in the dead of night, and that was not entirely by accident. It was the culmination of their program before they were to leave for the rest of the year, and this was the last thing they wanted to do. They had more or less gotten their other ducks in a row. There are some appropriations matters hanging fire, but this was the last big thing, and they did not get to it until late on Friday night. But I think there was also a sense that it was going to be a tough vote. They were going to need to do a lot of last-minute, shall we say, heavy lobbying, some of which takes place at a high volume of voice. And they did not particularly want to have all the world watching. So they thought 3 o'clock would probably not be a bad time. Now, they, of course, would have liked to have finished after 15 minutes, but it took 3 hours, and it was quite a scene.
3 hours. Let's remind people, the House of Representatives is not a roll call vote. They vote electronically. It's normally 15 minutes, and normally that's it.
Yeah, 15 minutes is plenty. You can really record a vote in the House in far less than 15 minutes, but 15 minutes is the courtesy period to allow members to come to the floor and be available to vote. They had a result at the end of far less than that. After an hour, the bill had essentially lost. It lost by a couple of votes. And that just was not an acceptable result from the standpoint of the House Republican leadership, so they kept the vote open while they worked on some of their own members and while they worked on some Democrats, and they turned 6 votes in that period of time. The last two coming just shortly before 6 a.m. as the sun was peeping over the horizon.
And there were, at least according to the newspaper accounts, the Republican speaker was ready to give up at a couple of moments and walk to the podium and announce that, hey, that's it, we lost. But, you know, they spotted one more member maybe, and then finally pulled it off.
I'm not sure there ever would have been a point where they were really willing to throw in the towel. I think they were just planning to do it until they got it done.
Our telephone number, if you'd like to join the conversation, is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And Barbara joins us on the line from Vista, California.
Yes, hi there. Thank you so much for your excellent programming. I only listen to NPR and KPBS. I do feel I will vote against any Democrat or any who votes, and I am a Democrat,
mm-hmm.
who votes against this bill. And there are three members in my in the party who I feel are really Republicans in Democrats' clothing, and that would be Zell Miller, and that would be Senator Baucus, and also Senator Brawl, who really I don't contribute to the DNC because I feel I don't want any of my money going to their reelection campaigns, although I'm thankful that Miller is not going to run again. He's an abomination to the party. But I also would vote for someone like Senator John McCain, because I think he is the only Republican I can see who really has the guts to stand up against his party.
Are you talking more about the energy bill here than Medicare?
Yes, the energy bill. I do feel that, I am a senior citizen, and I'm very concerned about Medicare and how it's going to affect us. And I'm very well versed with the. I've actually gotten onto the WaysandMeans.gov website, and I do have all the information about what is in this bill, which I think most Americans have not been given that information at all. And I'm very, very concerned that this is going to be the destruction of Medicare as we know it. And I have been in HMOs in the past and thrown out of them because of the shenanigans that go on with these private insurance companies. I don't trust insurance companies across the board. And I really think that once seniors do find out in 2006, when it's too late, actually, since there was the election will have taken place 2 years before, they're going to be furious. The only people who might come out benefiting are the destitute, the very poor, who were covered by Medicaid. And now Medicaid has been changed, and they've been thrown out of that.
Barbara, I guess what we're hearing from you is that these votes are very important to you.
Very, very important. I think I rely on my my primary coverage from Medicare, but I also receive my secondary from my former employer.
Well, you might be interested to hear, this is a poll that has just come out, a new survey by the University of Pennsylvania's National Annenberg Election Survey, released today, shows the country is pretty evenly split on the Medicare bill. 40% the bill said the bill should be passed, 42% said it should not. That's not a statistically significant difference. Interestingly, older people are less likely to support the bill. Only 33% of those over 65 said they liked it, and 49% said it should not be passed. There was also another case where Republicans and Democrats split. Democrats opposed the bill 48-36%. Republicans supported by about the same divide, 46-35%. Barbara, thanks very much for the call. We appreciate it.
Continue with your wonderful programming.
Thank you very much. Ron, talking about the political significance of this, beyond the strange session in the House late Friday and early Saturday, today in the Senate, you had three Democratic candidates all had events in either Iowa or New Hampshire, but Senators Kerry, Lieberman, and who's the third one?
I'm Edwards.
Blanking. Edwards, John Edwards, have all returned to Washington to cast their vote on this Medicare.
And to make a lot of speeches and to get on television, and that's what you do when you're running for president. They want to highlight their opposition to the elements of the bill that they oppose. There are also, of course, things in it that they are for and would like to press if they ever got to be president, but not with all the provisions they see as being poison pills designed to eventually privatize Medicare.
See if we can squeeze in one more quick call. Vivian's with us from Falls Church, Virginia.
Hi. My question is for your political expert there. In the vote on Saturday morning in the House, there were 12 Democrats who voted for that H.R. 1, that Medicare bill.
Mm-hmm.
My question is, did any of them, were any of them importuned or asked to change their vote? Did any of them try to change their vote and then fail to get recognition from the people who were presiding, the Republicans who were presiding over the House? I mean, was there any effort to change some votes on the part of the Democrats, knowing that it was so close and that the Republicans were obviously, working on it, too? Does anybody know anything about that?
Let's get an answer from Ron Elving.
The answer is yes. That's a very perceptive question. If you've watched the House in these moments of overtime, and these are extraordinary moments of overtime, you know that they can quickly gavel the vote to a close once they get the result they want, and that's what happened early Saturday morning.
We'll be talking with two members about what they did during that vote later. Ron Elving, thanks very much. We'll be back with more on this. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about the fight in the Congress over passage of two huge and important pieces of legislation, the energy and Medicare bills. How will the outcome of these votes affect your vote come Election Day 2004. You're invited to join our discussion. Our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. In a few minutes, we're going to be talking with members on both sides of the aisle about the efforts to get the Medicare bill through Congress in the early hours of Saturday morning. But first, Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist will be one who gets credit or blame if these two bills fail or pass in the U.S. Senate. Douglas Waller is congressional correspondent for Time magazine. He co-wrote the profile on Senator Frist in the December 1st issue of Time magazine. He joins us now from his office here in Washington to talk about the senator's performance thus far. And good to have you on Talk of the Nation, Doug.
Good to be here.
It's just about a year since Senator Frist took over the role of Majority Leader. How is he doing?
Well, he came into the job last December in a very, very difficult situation. You recall, Senate Republicans ousted their Majority Leader Trent Lott over the racially tinged remarks he had made at Strom Thurmond's 100th birthday party. Keep in mind, the Republican senators did not want to remove Trent Lott. He was actually popular within the caucus by a good many members. So Senator Frist had to spend a lot of time initially, A, learning the ropes as a majority leader, and also kind of shoring up his base of support in the party in the Senate. And it's been a learning process for him over the last year. He's made a few stumbles on the floor. I guess you'd call them rookie mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
But if he delivers on the Medicare and energy bills, particularly Medicare, it's like one Republican senator told me, it would be a monster home run, particularly for the 2004 elections.
Is as you mentioned, a couple of rookie mistakes. This is the big test, though.
Oh, it is, and he's been managing the Senate floor and also his side and the Senate itself in a fairly hardball fashion, and he makes no apologies for it. He walled out the top Democrats in the conference, the House Senate conference, on the Medicare bill. This was Senator Tom Daschle. So he wasn't excluded from the negotiations, and instead he cherry-picked the two Democrats he wanted to deal which was Senator John Breaux and Senator Max Baucus. Now, that's not an unheard-of procedure, but it's a pretty brassy one to be taking against the top Democrat for the opposition or for the other side.
Filibuster must be his least favorite word since coming on. Of course, he's been frustrated in a number of votes on judicial nominees by some of the same techniques, the filibuster, refusal to cut off debate, and now it looks as if, at least on the energy bill, he's got a sticky situation.
Oh, every majority leader hates filibuster, particularly when he's trying to get a bill through. But it's a tactic the minority uses. Now, they just had a vote on cloture several hours ago that'll cut off the filibuster. But now Senator Frist faced another challenge. The Democrats, as we speak, are raising a point of order on the Medicare bill. And if they get 40 votes on that, they could bring down the bill. So he's got a lot of work ahead of him. The ultimate question is whether he can deliver the goods.
Email question we got from Chris in Nashville. I must say how disappointed I am for what has happened in Congress over the past few weeks. I've been following the appropriations process closely. I am frustrated, he writes, at how more continuing resolutions seem to be the key to funding and government, especially in light of Senator Frist's promise not to do it this year. I'd be interested if your guests could comment on the pending omnibus appropriations legislation.
Yeah, a lot of Democrats don't like those big omnibus bills too, because you can slip in all kinds of things in there, objectionable items that make it more difficult to vote against the bill because you're voting against a huge budget amount. Senator Frist has had about as much trouble getting appropriations bills through the Senate and also the Republicans through the Congress as Senator Daschle did when he controlled the Senate. One thing Democrats were furious over is the fact that they agreed to stay in session on Veterans Day and skip all those valuable Veterans Day parades back in their home states in order to work on what they thought would be the appropriations bills. And then Senator Frist told Senator Daschle afterwards that he was going to spend 39 hours, or it turned out to be 39 hours, on a talkathon on judges. That made Daschle and the other Democrats just absolutely furious because they saw it as a colossal waste of time.
Senator Frist, before his being elected a majority leader in the Senate, was maybe I'm going too far, but a bit of a golden boy. He was not somebody who'd been in Congress as long as a lot of the other people, and was seen as something of a White House appointment rather than someone who emerged from the caucus. Is that an accurate picture?
Oh, it is. His first political race was 1994, and he was up until that point a very well-renowned heart and lung transplant surgeon. George Bush didn't hide the fact that he liked Bill Frist for the job to replace Trent Lott. The president was never really warm and close to Trent Lott, but Frist kind of portrays just the type of compassionate conservative image that George Bush likes. He's a world-renowned heart surgeon. On mm-hmm. vacations, he likes to jet to Africa to perform surgeries in some often very dangerous areas. He's got a Harvard-Princeton pedigree. He projects well on television. And he's just a kind of young, athletic type of senator that makes a good fit with the image that Bush wants to project.
And a large part of his political future might be at stake even as we speak. Doug Waller, thanks very much.
Good talking to you.
Doug Waller, congressional correspondent for Time magazine. He co-wrote the profile of Senator Frist that's in the December 1st issue of Time, and he joined us from his office here in Washington, D.C. Let's get some more callers involved and go to Alex, who's on the line from Santa Clara, California.
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, you're on the line, Alex.
Thank you, Neil. Wonderful program. We need things like this. My comment is going to be on Senator Feinstein, and basically, let me first say that privatization has generally tended to end up resulting in price gouging for the public. The Congress is supposed to be protecting the public, also promoting business and enterprise, but however, this Congress seems to be just bent on privatizing everything.
It sounds like you're talking about the Medicare bill primarily.
Yes, and basically, this is all part of the same neoliberal conservative agenda about how government can do no good and basically. But if we look at private industry, we also have Enron's and WorldCom's and what's going on in Wall Street right now.
Well, Senator Feinstein is one of the Democrats who has voted in favor of the Medicare bill. Will that figure into your vote in November?
Well, yes, because if there's a viable Democratic senator candidate, maybe even Ed Kibet, or he's been making noise about it, running against Feinstein, I would definitely be voting against Feinstein for doing this because
in the Democratic primary, but perhaps not against a Republican rival.
Not against a Republican rival. That is correct. I cannot support the kind of agenda that they have.
Okay, Alex. Thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Let's try now to go to Bob, and Bob is in Boise, Idaho.
Hi, Neil. Quick question for you. It has been decades that we've been talking about changes to the Medicare program and getting something done. Representative Gebhardt has been talking for eons about changes in Medicare, and yet nothing was done when he was majority leader and Democratic control of the House. We are now on the verge of historic legislation, not only in Medicare, but on energy bill. And as far as Senator Frist is concerned, this man, if this legislation passes, will go down in history as being able to pass major reform in Medicare for however you want to call it. There is some Medicare prescription in there, drug prescription, as Senator Feinstein has indicated. It's a start. It's a start, Neil.
So
I don't understand why we aren't talking about Democratic obstructionists when the vast majority of both houses are for this. You go on about the fact that the Democrats are invoking other means to delay this bill. Call it what it is, obstructionist. We're ready for some changes in this country, and it's happening under a Republican president. As much as you may not like it, and as much as Democrats may hate it, it didn't happen under Gebhardt, And I think, and it didn't happen when Daschle was majority leader. It didn't happen when Clinton had both houses. Why aren't we trumpeting the fact that we are on the verge of historic changes in this country?
Bob, thanks very much. Appreciate your call. Representative Mike Pence is on the line. He's a Republican who voted against the Medicare bill when it was on the floor of the U.S. House of Representatives. He's a Republican from Indiana. He joins us on the line from his home in Virginia. Thanks very much for being with us on Talk of the Nation.
Great to be with you, Neil.
During that three-hour vote we were discussing earlier, you were among those who were lobbied very strenuously by the House leadership and held on to your vote. You sustained your position. Can you tell us about that?
Well, it was an extraordinary evening. I didn't find out until I read the Post the next morning that it was by almost two times the longest vote in the history of the United States House of Representatives. Almost 3 hours, I think it was 2 hours and 50 minutes before it was over. And I can tell you from the time the gavel fell and they began to count the votes, the 25 of us Republicans that joined the Democrats in trying to stop this massive new drug entitlement from going forward and really to send it back to the drawing board where we could do something more fiscally responsible. Literally from go, Neil, the lobbying effort on the floor was consistent, and while it was cordial and civil, it was quite intense.
How intense?
Well, there's I'm a small town boy from southern Indiana, and having the Speaker of the House and the top leadership in the House coming up to you and to your colleagues and telling you about how important this bill is, having the president on the phone at 5 in the morning after he'd called many of our colleagues through the day from Air Force One, all of that gives you some sense of the environment. But I don't mean to suggest that it was at any time unpleasant. One of the best kept secrets about Congress is it really is jammed full of a lot of really good people. And other than a couple of exceptions, I don't remember a harsh word being exchanged between any members during the whole of the 3 hours.
As you mentioned, it's got to make your palms a little sweaty when you start talking to people at that level. There were some Republicans who did change their vote to go with the administration and the Republican leadership. Why did you hold out?
Well, I held out because I really do believe that government is too big and it spends too much. I came to Washington, D.C. after three times trying, Neil, to change and to reform entitlements. I didn't come to Washington to create new entitlements. And even though, as your last caller implied, there were a couple of meaningful changes to Medicare, a few marginal improvements, a couple of good policy proposals like health savings accounts, the elephant in the room in this bill was simply the largest new entitlement since 1965, that the day the president signs it, as it looks likely he will add $7.3 trillion in unfunded obligations to a Medicare system in the next 75 years that already has $13 trillion in unfunded obligations. So for me, it was really about being consistent with my core beliefs about limited government, but also it was about trying to do the right thing by my kids and grandkids.
Very quickly, how do you think this is going to play out come November?
Well, it's very difficult to say. I know that many conservatives around the country, me included, were very disappointed to see a Republican Congress and soon a Republican president sign the largest new entitlement in 40 years. But well beyond that, I'm fearful that we've created a program here that is much less generous than the prescription drug benefit that three out of four seniors already have, in many cases through a former employer. And if those corporations choose to drop seniors onto the Medicare system, it literally could create a very negative environment for individuals and leaders that supported this bill. I'm hoping that I'm wrong about that. I'm hoping that that they will be able to unfurl this program in a way that won't dislodge
Congressman
billions of seniors, but it may happen.
Congressman, thank you very much for being with us today.
Appreciate thank you, Neil.
It. Mike Pence is a Republican from Indiana. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And joining us now from Capitol Hill is Representative Barney Frank, a Democrat from Massachusetts. He voted against the Medicare bill, but I suspect for different reasons. Congressman, always good to have you on the program.
Thank you.
Tell us about that three-hour vote early Saturday morning. What kind of lobbying were the Democrats doing?
Well, we were talking to our members. There was one at that point who hadn't decided how he was going to vote, Congressman Wu. I think the 3 hours is very significant. In addition to my being very disappointed in the bill, you know, I thought we were going to have a choice, either a reasonable drug benefit paid for by weakening Medicare or Medicare kept intact so that we would then have an inadequate drug benefit. What we got from the Republicans was the worst of both worlds. It was an inadequate benefit financed by cuts in Medicare. But what was striking was the procedure. I mean this literally, not as an alarmist. What you saw Saturday morning, was confirmation that the Republicans have really ended parliamentary democracy as we have known it. And they haven't gone to authoritarianism, but they've gone to what's really been a kind of plebiscitary democracy. That is, people should now understand when they vote for a Republican for Congress, no matter what he or she says, when the crunch comes, if that vote is needed to get whatever the Republican leadership wants, it's going to be there. They, in other words, said to the Republicans, look, this is indefinite detention. You're not going anywhere until some of you change your votes. It's very hard, as Representative Pence said, he had the integrity to resist, but it's very hard for an individual member faced with all of the power of the leadership of the president, et cetera, always to resist. But This is a new element in American politics. That is the introduction into our congressional system of the notion of a disciplined, cohesive party of the sort we used to say was a European type. And it means, again, as I said, that the individual predilections of Republicans running for the House really isn't very important, because in the end, no matter how they think and what they think, enough of them will be bludgeoned into going along with the leadership. So it's, as I said, no longer a parliamentary democracy, but a plebiscitary one.
We just have a few seconds left, Congressman, but there would be some in the audience who might suspect, the Democrats would be happy to do the same kind of thing.
No, the Democrats never did. Once Jim Wright held it open for about a half hour so one guy could come back and change his vote, and people were very upset, and this just did not happen. I mean, people who say that are unaware. Nothing like this has ever happened. The previous time that the roll call was open under the Democrats, the longest was a half hour. And it wasn't just that it was 3 hours. It was very clear. By the way, if they couldn't have switched those two votes, they then planned to adjourn the session with the bill still pending by the technical move of reconsideration. In other words, the Republicans have now announced no Republican will be let loose from all of this pressure if he or she dares. Look, let's put it this way. A Republican can vote however he or she wants, as long as it's irrelevant. But when that vote becomes crucial to the outcome, there will be overwhelming pressure, and know that it's qualitatively different than anything under the Democrats.
Congressman Frank, thank you so much. Barney Frank is a Democrat from Massachusetts. He joined us from his office on Capitol Hill.